Iambic Audiobooks presents Race for the Air, Book 2 of the Prophecies of Balitor series by Kirsty Ridderford, read by Ruth Golding. Chapter 1. Nothing stirred. The young sentry rubbed his eyes and continued along the battlements towards the hut that served as a guardhouse, his breath leaving long streams of vapour that lingered in the air behind him. He stamped his feet as he walked, in an attempt to coax the blood back into his frozen toes. Then, just before he reached the guardhouse, he turned and began to walk back the way he had come. The land beyond Quadrivium's walls remained as silent and deserted as ever. A faint mist had appeared with the grey light of dawn, and it hugged the ground, giving the impression that the derelict buildings that littered the open grassland were floating. The sentry paused and rubbed his eyes once more. He had been looking at the same view every night for the past few weeks, but now something seemed out of place. He scanned the ruins, trying to identify what had changed. Finally, his eyes came to rest on an abandoned cottage. In the shadows of its crumbling walls, sitting absolutely still, he made out the figure of a very tall and slender cat. It was larger than any cat the sentry had ever seen, and it appeared to be observing him. He shifted nervously and glanced over his shoulder towards the guardhouse. When he looked back, the cat was gone.
Nimrod!
The whisper was very loud in the stillness of the dawn, making him jump. A face peered round the door of the hut, followed by an arm which beckoned furiously to him. Nimrod marched over.
"Why are you whispering?"
he said, speaking louder than necessary to cover his nervousness.
"Shh!"
said the other sentry.
"Come and look at this."
Nimrod allowed himself to be led through the wooden hut onto the next section of battlements that were patrolled by his best friend Marcus, who now clutched his arm in an iron grip.
"Look over there, next to the old brick kiln,"
whispered Marcus. Before his eyes had located the kiln, Nimrod had already guessed what he would see. This time he made sure he got a good look before it disappeared. The cat sat facing the wall, its head proudly raised and its paws placed neatly side by side in front of its lean body. It was far too big to be a domestic cat, thought Nimrod. He wondered briefly whether it was a wild cat, but he had never seen one this close to the city before. He gave a start as the cat suddenly got to its feet in one fluid movement and approached the wall, moving with purpose and a powerful grace. Ignoring the two sentries watching from above, it began to pace up and down, lashing its tail from side to side as it stared up at the high wall.
"As if it's trying to find a way in,"
whispered Marcus. Nimrod nodded distractedly. He was trying to gauge whether the creature was a danger to the city, and whether it would be a good idea to wake their sergeant major. They had strict instructions not to disturb him unless the city was under attack, and Nimrod wasn't sure that one cat, however large, constituted such an emergency. Marcus suddenly squeezed his arm. Nimrod glanced at his friend, but the other sentry was staring intently into the mist. Nimrod followed his gaze to see a second cat appear, as large as the first. Slowly, almost lazily, it strolled over to join the other cat and fell into step beside it. After a moment, it moved away to sit on the grass. Then, from a different direction, a third cat appeared, followed shortly after by a fourth, and then a fifth. Each approached the pacing cat before moving away to join the others. Soon, there were more than a dozen cats seated in a rough semicircle facing the wall.
"It's like they're reporting back,"
said Nimrod thoughtfully.
"Do you think we should wake the sergeant major?"
asked Marcus, voicing what his friend had been thinking. At that moment, the first ray of sun spilled over the horizon, the light picking out the spots in the golden fur of the assembled cats. The pacing cat stopped mid-stride, one paw still raised. Then suddenly it turned and bounded into the mist, quickly followed by the other cats. The two sentries looked at each other and then back at the now empty space beyond the wall. The mist began to dissipate as the light grew brighter and the shadowy ruins took on a more solid appearance. The cats had left no trace of their visit. Although neither sentry spoke, each knew what the other was thinking. Had they imagined the whole thing? Nimrod cleared his throat.
I'd best get back to my side of the guardhouse, he said gruffly. If old Frosty catches me on this side, there'll be trouble.
A massive explosion drowned out the end of his sentence, and the two sentries were almost thrown to the ground by the force of the blast. There was the sound of falling masonry, and a plume of dust rose up beyond the guardhouse. Nimrod raced back through the hut and skidded to a halt, clutching the doorframe just in time to save himself from falling into a gaping hole. Nothing but rubble remained of the battlements he had been patrolling just moments before. The force of the explosion reached as far as the dungeons below the barracks in the grounds of the palace. The pale-skinned man reached out a bony hand to the wall to steady himself, grimacing as his fingers touched the damp, slimy stones.
"What was that?"
asked the other man, looking up from where he was slumped on the ground. A large iron ball lay on the ground next to him, attached to his ankle by a length of chain.
"That was the diversion."
The pale man looked pleased with himself as he wiped his soiled hand carefully on the other man's sleeve.
"At last,"
said the man on the ground. He heaved a sigh of relief and tried to lever himself up into a standing position.
"Will they know where we are, or do we wait for the guards to be distracted and sneak out by ourselves to join them?"
"Neither," answered the pale man, placing a hand on the other man's shoulder and pushing him back down.
"It's time for me to put Plan B into effect. I must see the king immediately."
He turned to go, but was stopped by the other man's surprisingly strong arm grasping his leg.
"You can't just leave me here,"
he pleaded as tears began to roll down his cheeks.
"What about our agreement?"
The pale man looked down in disgust at the man grovelling at his feet.
"The agreement where I made you mayor of this city, where you have lived in luxury and splendour for the past 10 years and more?"
The man nodded eagerly, his damp cheeks wobbling.
"That agreement expired with the failure of Plan A," said the pale man, finally pulling his leg free of the other's grasp. "Don't forget that you have been exposed as a traitor. You kidnapped the king's son and heir, and then you kidnapped the Dowager Bella, my own mother. You've made your bed, Ponsonby. Now it's time for you to lie in it."
Ponsonby looked up at him in confusion.
"But everything I did was for you, master. It was all part of our grand plan to rule the kingdom."
"And the plan was flawed," snapped the pale man. "There was too much that could go wrong, and it did. Someone has to bear the consequences."
He turned and rapped on the thick wooden door.
"Guards!" "Wait!" cried Ponsonby desperately. "It's only a matter of time before the king finds out that you were behind it all. There are others who know of our association."
He hesitated for a second before continuing.
"I'll tell him myself. I'll tell him everything. How you stole the Book of Prophecies and tried to use it to unite the rebels against him. How I infiltrated the council on your instructions."
The pale man stood perfectly still facing the cell door, his back to the ex-mayor, who was now almost hysterical. Finally, he squared his shoulders and turned to face him.
Don't be ridiculous, Ponsonby. I wasn't going to abandon you,
he said with a kindly tone that was so unexpected it made the other man pause for breath.
Look, I even brought you some supplies.
He unslung the bag from his shoulder and dropped it on the ground in front of the other man. A loaf of bread and a haunch of venison spilled out, and Ponsonby fell on them eagerly.
I need to go now to execute step one of Plan B, but I'll be back.
The pale man paused for a moment, watching the other tear into the meat as though he hadn't eaten in days.
I may be some time.
The pale man flung open the double doors and entered the throne room. His confident stride faltered for a fraction of a second as he noticed the king sitting in what he already thought of as his throne. But he quickly recovered and moved swiftly through the ranks of assembled men. He approached the king and went down on one knee before him, noticing with pleasure that his mother, the Dowager Bella, had been reinstated to her position on the council.
Sire,
he murmured, glancing briefly at his mother through his long, pale blonde eyelashes. As he had expected, she was gazing at him lovingly.
She would be a useful ally, he thought to himself.
Rise, Damien, said the king impatiently. Has the traitor spoken?
The pale man was pleased that his mother had already laid the groundwork for him. It was obvious that neither she nor the king suspected him of colluding with the ex-mayor. He drew himself up to his full height and raised his voice so that everyone in the room would hear what he had to say.
Aye, sire. He confessed to summoning the rebels only moments before I arrested him. It is the sound of their cannon fire that disturbed your morning slumber. But they are merely the advance party. The treacherous vermin admitted that an entire army of rebels is on the march towards Quadrivium as I speak, intent on overthrowing your majesty.
There was murmured dissent from the assembled men.
None of our spies have brought news of such an army, called a voice.
The pale man turned a second too late to identify the speaker. He ran his eyes over the councillors, recognizing many who had been recruited by Ponsonby. He saw fear on their faces and wondered where their loyalties lay now that the mayor had been arrested. He doubted whether he could trust any of them. Summoning his most scathing tone, he said,
And did your scouts forewarn you of the rebels who are attacking Quadrivium's walls at this very moment?
As if to emphasize his words, there was a muffled explosion.
No,
it was the king who spoke. And the pale man turned back to face him, his face composed in a more respectful expression.
All available men were searching for my son, continued the king. As you are no doubt aware, Prince Alexander was kidnapped by the traitor Ponsonby and was rescued only yesterday by your own mother, the Dowager Bella.
I understand that your men were preoccupied, sire, said the pale man. But I believe the kidnapping reveals an urgent need for better security for you, your family, and for Quadrivium. For a start, I would suggest that you place your men under my command and let me see off this approaching army.
There was a collective intake of breath from the king's councillors before a babble of voices broke out.
This is only a skirmish.
There is no evidence of an approaching army. It's just a few rebels
How
causing
do we
trouble.
Know Ponsonby even speaks the truth.
At that moment, the doors to the throne room burst open, and a soldier dressed in the uniform of the king's household guard stood in the doorway. He dropped down on one knee.
Forgive me for intruding, sir, but an army approaches from the east. What are your orders?
The king looked at Damien.
It appears your information is correct after all, Lord Damien. What would you advise we do?
Damien's features betrayed no emotion, but he was pleased that the king had finally used his title, to which, as the queen's brother, he was entitled. He appeared to consider the question carefully before answering.
"My first priority is your safety, sire. Allow me to remain by your side as your personal bodyguard throughout the forthcoming battle."
There was more disgruntled muttering from the assembled men. The pale man ignored them and continued,
"Assemble your troops by the east gate. Every available fighting man needs to be armed and ready. And put your men under my control. I know the way the rebels fight."
A grey-haired man rose unsteadily to his feet.
"Sir, the question of your safety and the command of your army is surely a decision for your council. Lord Damian does not understand our democratic process, having been absent from Quadrivium for many years."
Before the king could reply, the soldier spoke up from the doorway.
"There is no time for debate. The army draws ever nearer. Sire, I need your orders this very minute."
The king looked thoughtfully at his councillors. After Mayor Ponsonby's betrayal, he was no longer sure who he could trust, whereas Damian, despite a long and unexplained absence, was his wife's brother and son of the Dowager Bella, for whom he had a lot of respect. He turned abruptly and spoke to the soldier.
"Do as Lord Damian says. Prepare the men for battle, but await my command."
The man left the room in a hurry. Ignoring his counsellors, the king beckoned Damian closer and lowered his voice.
"So tell me, Lord Damian, what can we expect from this rebel army?"
The pale man hid his smile behind his hand.
"First, sire, we must determine exactly how large a force it is. It approaches from the east, so I believe our best viewpoint would be the southeast battlements."
The king nodded slowly and then stood.
"I must dress for battle. Meet me in the guardhouse above the southeast gate at 1:30.
With a curt nod to his councillors, he strode from the room. Damian waited with bowed head until the king had left, and then turned to face the councillors. With the exception of his mother, all of them were staring at him with a mixture of hatred and envy on their faces.
Queen Katrina tiptoed into the royal nursery and approached the cot. Two nursemaids sat either side of the sleeping baby, looking unnaturally alert, determined that the prince would not be kidnapped again, at least not on their shift. They stood and curtsied to the queen.
"He's sleeping like a little angel, your majesty," whispered one. "Not a peep from him all night," said the other.
The queen smiled and dismissed them with a wave of her hand. They left the nursery reluctantly and with many backward glances. As soon as they were gone, the queen picked up the sleeping baby and sat down carefully in the rocking chair beside the fire, tucking the blanket around the young prince's soft, warm body. He made a mewling sound but didn't wake. After rocking gently for a while, she undid the top two buttons of his sleep suit and eased it back to reveal his plump shoulder with its distinctive coronet birthmark. Her husband, the king, had exactly the same birthmark. It was the mark of royal lineage, a strange quirk of nature that branded both the present ruler and the next in line to the throne. It was said that if the king ever failed to produce an heir, a commoner would be born with the coronet birthmark and would rise to rule the kingdom. Until her son had been born, the queen suspected that many an expectant mother secretly hoped to find her own newborn marked with the coronet. But finally she had given her husband a son and heir, complete with the birthmark. Queen Katrina bent her head and gently kissed her son's shoulder, leaving a smudge of soft tinted wax from her lips, which she absently wiped away with her thumb. She frowned. Rising, she carried the baby over to the small bathtub where a jug of water stood warming over the fire in readiness for his morning bath. She emptied some of the water into the tub, then dipped in a flannel and rubbed the baby's shoulder with increasing vigour, oblivious to his indignant cries as he was roused from his slumber. "No," she gasped softly, hardly able to draw breath. Then, suddenly, an agonized wail came rushing out of her. "No!"